From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C., and Philippe Gillet, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro. And here are the issues. A suicide bomber detonated a sophisticated bomb outside a concert arena in Manchester, England, killing more than 20 people and injuring scores, most of them women and girls. President Trump visited Saudi Arabia, Israel, the Vatican, Belgium, and Italy in his first major overseas trip, but got mixed reviews on his efforts to promote counterterrorism and bolster NATO. Back home, the Trump administration unveiled a new budget proposal that purports to end the deficit, but does so by cutting foreign aid, the State Department, and assistance to poor Americans. Michael, we're going to start with this horrendous event in England. Horrible bombing, 22 dead, many, many injured, lots of young children, parents. What do we know about the suicide bomber and where the investigation is leading?
And again, this is one of those things that we've sat here too many times, Barbara, over the time we've known each other and talked about these things. And it's so hard to talk about them dispassionately when you see the faces and the reactions of the families. But we'll try to do that. We know that the bomber is a 22-year-old male who is a British citizen, who is the son of Libyan refugees who had come into the country a generation before. We know that the fact that he had connections to Libya is very different because statistics say that something like 1% of any type of terrorist activity or related terrorist activity, that type of thing, less than 1% is related to Libya. That is usually from other countries. So this is different. We do know that it has some commonalities with other things that have happened, though, because he is sort of that disaffected youth type of thing. And we know that he is directly connected to ISIS. We know that ISIS has claimed responsibility for this. And the intelligence services have confirmed that, and they are actively looking for a network. We have the UK at its very highest level of preparedness for an attack. Theresa May, the prime minister, is saying that another attack is imminent. The state of, we want to say preparedness, but maybe unpreparedness is a better word right now for what we're having because of this attack. And it really just, we're getting all too used to this, you know, in a way, you know, this sort of attack on these innocent people who are out, the youngest and most vulnerable among us in society, who are somehow attacked because of their participating in what is deemed to be sort of immoral behavior.
A concert,
or
a pop concert.
A pop concert. So the authorities are at their highest level of readiness and alertness. They are saying that an attack is imminent. They are crashing into homes and looking for the rest of this network.
Right.
And we do know now that this is not a lone wolf attack. This is a network. This is something that was very, very planned, very, very systematic. And we're on the lookout for where the rest of this attack could be.
Yeah. Philippe, I mean, Michael says that Libyans are not typically involved, but we do know that ISIS set up quite a potent cell, I think, in Libya, that as Western-led forces kind of move in on the so-called caliphate in Syria and Iraq, that attention has turned to ISIS cells in other places, particularly in Libya, which is essentially still a failed state, isn't it, all these years after Gaddafi's overthrow.
I don't know where this figure comes from, the 1%. Maybe it's in exporting terrorism, or I don't know. There is a lot of local terrorism, definitely, in Libya.
Yeah.
I don't know about any figure, but obviously this terror attack again shows that it's pretty easy for a young terrorist who is known for his radical ideas, because his people close to him have called the police a month and years before to signal that he was worrying to them. He went through Turkey, through an airport in Germany. He managed to enter a concert hall with a bomb.
He was outside the hall. He was in area just outside,
Still, I mean, there are practical issues, questions of security at stake here again.
Yeah, I think one question really is about capacity. This was from British authorities. They said that MI5 manages about 500 active investigations and that Abedi was among, quote, a large pool of people, unquote, whose risk was kept under review. I mean, there's just a question of how, and we saw this in France, we saw this in Belgium, how many people can you monitor 24/7?
I think in France we have 12,000 what we call S dossiers, if you want.
Security
dossiers. Under surveillance. And obviously, we don't have the people to follow those guys closely all the time.
Yeah. In this case, though, he had just come back from Libya, and, you know, perhaps that should have raised some sort of red flags among the authorities. But, you know.
Although, when you come back through Istanbul and then Dusseldorf, it's not necessarily obvious to the border control people that you come from Libya.
True.
Yeah, it's true. But you raise a great question about resources. Just how many people can you watch at the same time? And even if you're watching, there has to be a point at which you say, here's where we're going to do something about it. Because under our current system of justice, just thinking about something or talking about something still isn't a crime necessarily. So at what point do you say, well, this is the point where we can walk in through a door and say, well, you're now abducted or you're arrested as opposed to being under surveillance? And it's a tricky tipping point that you have there. So you have this, you know, the practicality of how you enforce the law and still maintain the rule of law, you know, in a civil society.
Yeah. Philippe, there's another issue, which is, of course, that the suicide bomber was a British citizen. He was born in Britain, born in Manchester. And, of course, we've had much talk of visa bans, travel bans. The U.S. Court has just once again upheld the decision to strike down a visa ban, a travel ban that the Trump administration has tried to impose. But all the travel bans in the world aren't going to stop a citizen of a country from moving around freely. So one wonders whether that sort of approach is misplaced and whether there oughtn't be more resources devoted to things like community outreach so that you can spot the troubled people before they take horrible steps like this.
You're probably right. Community outreach, yes. We have, for instance, big difference between France and the UK in terms of communitarism. We try to fight against communitarism in France. It doesn't work. They accept much more a certain type of communitarism in the UK, arguing that it makes the society as a whole safer, which is not really true either. So there is no way we will always stop and identify those young lost souls ahead of their actions. And I think in Europe, and probably a little more than here in the United States, we admit that. I mean, we know that there will always be some level of risk in some areas. And there are a lot of societies who've been living with that. I mean, I spent years in Jerusalem at a time when you had a bus bombed every 2 weeks, and people managed to leave almost normally, and they eventually found solutions, but it's a small place, it's totally different.
Well, or a place like Lebanon that has seen terrific violence, including suicide violence, for many years. It's horrible to think, though, that we in the West now are going to have to just simply get used to it. But before we move on, Michael, I think we should say a word about the reaction of the Mancunians, I believe they call themselves, the people of Manchester, which has just been fantastic. There was a piece, I think it was in the New York Times, about how diverse this city is. It has people from literally every country on the globe, and it appears that they have been able to draw together in the aftermath of this tragedy.
They have, and actually no strangers to activity.
IRA bombings, yeah.
IRA bombings, I believe, 1996, that leveled a portion of the city. Yet the Mancunians, very resilient people, a tough people, and a diverse people. And you hit it on the head, Barbara, when you say that as we battle ISIS on the battlefield, we need to battle isolationism, you know, in these cities, you know, to really sort of break up these pockets of sort of cultural just division. They're just separate from society. These are the festering points for these sorts of things. And the more we can break those things up, the better chance we have of doing this. And one last thing is that we do have an election coming up next month. And it'll be interesting to see what happens when you have Theresa May, the conservative, who is perceived as more hawkish and strong against terrorism, how that's going to affect the election against the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who has actually, in a previous part of his career, has supported the IRA.
And oh my God.
that's likely to come up now during the election. Look for that during debates and speeches. So as much as you hate to bring it to that point, although it may seem coarse, there is a political component to all of this, too.
There is a political component to everything. I want to move on now because I think our major topic will be the first overseas trip of President Trump. Certainly counterterrorism, anti-ISIS, this has been a focal point for his trip throughout. I guess we'll start in Saudi Arabia, Philippe, where he had a lavish welcome and seemed to have had a very good time. His main deliverable was a huge arms package, another $110 billion, although some of that, I think, was already Obama-era arms deals, and also a promise of Saudi investment in the United States through various infrastructure projects and so on. I'm just curious what your reaction was to the to his visit to Saudi Arabia and whether you think it's really going to amount to anything.
It was framed in very ambitious terms. I mean, the fact that you would gather people representing almost every Sunni Arab country in the region and
beyond, some from Africa and Asia too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, and have them engaged in anti-terrorism and so on. I think it was a good start with some more distance. I'm a bit surprised that it seems that President Trump is more at ease, what we call the complex Middle East, than with natural friends and allies in Europe. I haven't seen yet a foreign policy, frankly. Mm-hmm. Have seen a trip where he avoided major blunders, if you want, and maybe that's sufficient for the American public. I don't think it's enough on the world stage, in the sense that we don't know what he wants and what he thinks. He's been very close to the Saudis and the Sunni Arabs, and quite aggressive with Iran. Although there is a new president, rather moderate in Tehran, and maybe it's an opportunity to move a little bit. He's been very, very close to Prime Minister Netanyahu, and when he went to see the Palestinians, he didn't say a word about the Palestinian state or even the settlements. And when you look at him besides the European partners, I mean, he's chastised them for not paying enough, owing money, which it doesn't work like that. I mean, he's been explained that
several times.
Ten times. I mean, it's not like people have to pay something to NATO.
Right.
Of course, he didn't endorse explicitly Article 5 of NATO.
We're going to come back to that. Yeah. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of El Monitor, and joining me today are Philippe Gellier of Le Figaro and Michael Williams of CBS Radio. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Michael, going back to Saudi, in terms of a counterterrorism approach, how does having Saudi Arabia buy $100 billion of American weapons help in a counterterrorism approach if we're talking about disaffected youth, if we're talking about people responding to failed states and so on? I'm just, to me, the two just don't connect. It's a very nice payoff to the United States for this sort of continuing this implicit promise to protect Saudi Arabia in perpetuity from its enemies. But does it really deal with terrorism?
I don't think so. I agree with you. I don't see necessarily the connection. I think on this trip, there is one thing that Donald Trump believes in absolutely positively and unequivocally. That is Donald Trump. He believes in the force of his own personality and the belief that that personality can change long-standing hostilities and bring new friendships and relationships to bear, really because of a handshake and a smile. And you look at how he characterizes some of the meetings with people. It's like, they're awesome. They're amazing. This is a fantastic guy.
Yeah.
He's a fantastic guy. I mean, these are the terms and the currency that he works in. So it's dollars. The $110 billion to him is like, well, if you're going to do that much business with me, you must be a friend. And I think that's the way he sees that relationship. And also the fact that he feels like he's made a friend in Bibi Netanyahu. He's made a friend in King Salman. And I can bring these guys together, over a slice of pizza, and get this thing done. How hard can it be? He says. So I don't see the connection. I agree with you, Philippe, in that there is a foreign policy. The question is there a consistent foreign policy? Because it changes from moment to moment. It's changed from moment to moment on the campaign trail. It's changed in the White House. We don't know who's running it. Nominally, it's Rex Tillerson. Practically, it could be anyone from Steve Bannon to Miller to Jared Kushner to Ivanka. Who knows? Who has it? It's maybe the last person that spoke to him in his ear.
And he mentioned this principle realism. What is that?
What is that principle realism?
I mean, his foreign policy would be guided. I mean, that was mentioned during the trip. Guided by principled realism. we are looking for the principle, because I can see the realism, I mean, some sort of the realism, which is where are the interests of the of my country, which is fair, but I don't see the principle so far.
Yeah, I think everyone, of course, noticed that he said he would not lecture a room full of Arab and Middle Eastern autocrats, but he, of course, spent most of his time lecturing United States' closest allies in NATO about, as you pointed out, their failure to pay up the 2% of the GDP that they agreed to spend on defense. And, Philippe, there were some scenes that were just really strange. I mean, there was the video of him meeting the new French president, Macron, and they shook hands, but in a way that was not very friendly. Maybe you could describe it.
Well, it was a men handshake, I don't know. I mean, they wanted to evaluate one another. Maybe he wanted to check this young guy. Does he have a strong arm and is he able to stand my handshake? I don't know. I've seen Donald Trump doing that many times, actually, with quite many people. He wants to give a, you know, manly...
I wouldn't call it manly. I would call it bullying. I mean,
maybe
myself.
Maybe bullying. He was clearly bullying with the Montenegrin
Him out of the way.
Yeah, at the NATO meeting, because he really pushed him. He shoved him.
He really does have sort of this handshake diplomacy and this policy going on. If you look at the handshakes, you can tell so much. Pulling in Comey, even, you know, for the handshake.
Is it diplomacy or something else?
It could be a type of diplomacy, but you can certainly tell how he feels about a person by how he shakes their hand, or if he chooses to shake their hand, Angela Merkel.
Yeah, you know, he didn't shake Angela Merkel's hand in front of the cameras. Right?
Yeah, I think that this is clearly like the low point as he gets to the European and the NATO part of the trip. That was a very, very disappointing to me performance by a president. As formally, you expect the president to come and be the leader of NATO and absolutely, positively, in no questionable terms, express support for Article 5. Every president does that. He didn't do it. His press secretary, Sean Spicer, says, well, the president certainly is in favor of this. It means nothing when Sean Spicer says it. It means everything when the president
absolutely.
Says
and
it.
And he's there for, I mean, they had a remnant of the World Trade Center, right?
Yeah.
There was a ceremony over 9/11. And, you know, what better time? I mean, the only time NATO has invoked Article 5 was in defense of the United States.
Defense of the United States,
after 9/11. And there are still European troops in Afghanistan. There are even in places like Syria, as part of the forces there, as part of the anti-ISIS coalition. So it was extraordinary.
I see some sort of strategy, although I don't know where it aims exactly, but I think there is some sort of strategy in Donald Trump's mind, being nice with people who are not necessarily your friends at the beginning. I mean, in Riyadh, a lot of people were distrustful of the United States. And you're dealing with Gulf states that have been sponsoring radical Islam, Wahhabism, for years and decades, from Indonesia to the Balkans.
Right.
I mean, and those are the people you want to make friends with.
Yeah. But Trump didn't say anything about the Saudi educational system. He didn't say anything about Wahhabi Islam in his
about
speech.
Women's status.
Let me see if I understand this. So you're kinder to people.
Yeah. And you know that Europeans are your friends anyway, and they need
you.
They need you, so you don't need to be nice.
I
understand that, but it's still very strange, because I think there will be a downside, in the sense that you could see on the face of the European leaders Thursday in NATO that they were thinking, wow, what we've read in the media is true. I mean, the guy is really like that. We've seen him now.
And when the United States needs Europe for something, and I was thinking particularly of Iran, you mentioned Iran, the Iranians reelected by an overwhelming margin a very pragmatic president, Hassan Rouhani, who was, of course, instrumental in the nuclear deal. The United States now wants to pile more sanctions on Iran. You know, will the Europeans follow the lead, or will they say, no, we're going to intensify our engagement with Iran just out of reaction, out of spite almost? I mean, there will be times when we need Europe to be on our side, and why would they be now?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, the president has this list, and I call them his buddies and baddies. You know, so he has his buddies. So Netanyahu is a buddy. King Salman is a buddy. Angela Merkel is a baddie. You know, she's the Germans overall,
of the Philippines.
Is a buddy. And you look at the list and you see what's in common, and he likes the strong man. He likes the enforcer, someone who's seen in his mind to be a tough guy, because that's sort of what he looks up to. It's just a personality trait of his, but it doesn't work for policy. It just doesn't. Look, I see this policy that he's taken to NATO as a foreign policy that's being driven by domestic policy guys like Steve Bannon, because he's talking to his base. When you stand up in front of NATO and talk about something that's not fair to American voters, that rings such a bad note for me. I've never heard a president say something like that about...
But it plays well with his base.
Exactly. Right? So the 35%, he's trying to keep them maintained, keep those on, maybe looking to 2018 elections. But again, in a properly running administration, there would be a stopgap. There would be a firewall against someone saying, look, you can't do a domestic policy speech. You can't do a campaign speech
in front of a foreign
on a NATO platform. You just can't do it. Again, it just shows sort of the naivete and the inexperience of this group and how it hurts them and it hurts us worse.
And I think when you're president of the United States, of course, you have to wonder what is your aim? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can try to make friends in the Middle East, although you know that it's a very complex situation, and maybe you will achieve a little more in fighting ISIS and a little more in selling arms. But what you can achieve with friends in Europe is a lot more and much easier. And it doesn't request a lot from you. I mean, you don't need to create problems in Europe where you don't have any. Mm-hmm. And even though you want to improve the situation elsewhere.
Philippe, do you think partly, I mean, you know, it's interesting because there was an election in Europe, Brexit, before Trump was elected, which pleased him very much, which he supported, and he kind of saw as a harbinger of his own victory. Since his election, all the elections have gone against Trump-style populists and right-wingers, and they've all gone toward pro-European Union people and so on. Also, he arrived in NATO. He'd just come from a lecture from the Pope about climate change as well. So, you know, I wonder if part of it isn't this kind of vanity that, you know, the world seemingly is not following his lead. His victory in the United States was isolated. Its legitimacy, of course, is still being questioned by all these various investigations into Russian interference in our elections and so on. So maybe it was just a little bit of personal pique in a way that he had to meet Macron and not Le Pen, you know?
Maybe. I'm not sure about the reason. I think it's definitely counterproductive. It doesn't bring anything, I mean, except what you said about his base and the fact that, you know, I'm the tough guy and I request them to pay more and to pay their bills, as he says. But on the long term, I mean, I think if you are someone living in the Baltic states, where you feel every day the pressure of Russia, military pressure, and you're scared that you can be overwhelmed in a matter of hours, and when you meet this president at a NATO summit and hear him, then you go back home and you're really worried and you start to try to find other ways to achieve your own security.
That's exactly right.
I want to move to our budget very quickly, but I should note that there are four countries in NATO besides the U.S. that spend 2% of their GDP on defense, and among them are Poland and Estonia.
Yeah. So France is at 1.8% and doing a lot in Sahel and in Africa. I mean, to be fair with my country, I think Donald Trump could acknowledge what France is doing against terrorism.
Well, we don't have enough time to go into the Trump budget, Michael, but I'll give you the final word on this. Big increases for defense, big cuts for many, many, many social programs, including ones that would affect those who voted for Trump. So, I mean, we know it's Congress. This is not the budget that will be approved, but still, what's the signal it sends?
Well, any administration's budget is a statement of its values, because we know that it's going to be chopped to pieces. The Congress has the power of the purse. And if you look at this budget and you look at the values and you look where the zeros are and you look where the increases are, it's a very clear message that building that wall is important, building a bigger military is important, but children, poor people, sick people are absolutely not. The worst things that I've heard for a long time in Washington were some of the things that were said by the OMB director, Nick Mulvaney. One of the things he said, and I'll leave you with this, where he said that there's a program that gives food to children who go to school, and he wanted to cut the program. And he said, that's supposed to improve proficiency in children, and there's no evidence that giving food to those children has improved their proficiency. And
Thank you, Mr. Scrooge.
Yeah. I don't know how you follow that.
That's all the time we have. We'll leave that to our listeners. Joining us today were Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C., and Philippe Gillier, U.S. chief correspondent for Le Figaro. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski, and our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.